This is WGHN in Grand Haven, Michigan. The Grand Haven Board of Light and Power, the folks who help you live better electrically, invite you to stay tuned now for the following full hour long public service presentation. This then is
The Year in Review.
WGHN News Department presents a one-hour wrap-up of the major stories in and around the Tri-Cities that made the headlines in 1966. The actual sounds and voices, the big developments in the community, the year in review. Various elections made the news right from the start of 1966 to the very end of the year. In January, the first major annexation attempt in Grand Haven was recorded, and it was a flop. Officials of the city had hoped to annex about 642 acres of Grand Haven Township to the city proper. The issue failed both in the city and in the area considered for annexation. Here's what Mayor William Cresson said after the results were known.
We're sorry that some of the township people who signed the petition for the vote to annex to the city of Grand Haven decided to vote against the proposal. We're also sorry that the citizens of Grand Haven have turned down this opportunity to grow. We have much to be thankful for in the Grand Haven area, but we also have much work to do together if we are to be competitive and not fall behind in our efforts to make this a good economical area, as well as a fine place in which to live. It is too bad that there were some misunderstandings which arose because an outside group was out to defeat the issue and either intentionally or unintentionally misrepresented the facts. I am sure, however, that there will be times in the future in which districts will want to join hands with the city in order to develop the potential that we are so fortunate to have in this area and also to ensure a more orderly growth. If people are willing to share together in this effort, we believe more can be accomplished than if divided. The City Council tried to conduct itself in an honorable and forthright manner in processing this request for annexation. We will continue to do so in the future.
In May, residents of Robinson Township voted in favor of getting fire protection for the township, which has never had a fire department. They approved a levy of 4 mills for 5 years, to eventually raise $75,000 for a new township hall and fire station and a new fire truck. They'll get it in a few years. And residents of the Coopersville area voted to make the community a fifth-class city. The new city, effective January 1st, will be about double the size of the village of Coopersville. After the initial election, voters later adopted a new city charter. Following that election in December, Coopersville Observer editor Merlin Shears had this report.
A change from that of a village to that of a city will take place January 1, 1967. The result of the special election held Tuesday, December 13, in the village of Coopersville. Not only will there be a change in the status, but also a change in the area with approximately 1 square mile of land added. Although not heavily populated, the area does leave room for expansion, both commercial and industrial. Voters gave their overwhelming approval to the adoption of the city charter, which was written by the 9 charter commissioners elected June 1, 1966. A total of 503 votes were cast in the special election, with 307 yes votes to 139 no votes. 16 absent voters' ballots were included in the total. Many voters overlooked the proposal. Fenton, Lawrence Garthwaite, Leonard Castellan, and Gay Grossenbacher. The vote, which was a high percentage of the registered voters, corresponded very closely to that when the Charter Commission was elected during the June 1, 1966 election. Newly elected officials will begin their office on the effective date of the Charter, January 1, 1967, at which time the control of the officers of the village of Coopersville and the township of Polkin over any of that part of a new city shall cease and be superseded by that of the officers of the city of Coopersville. Adoption of the Charter by the voters was, in all respects, a vote of confidence for the men who worked many hours in laying the foundation for the type of government to be used in the new, by the new city officers. Many are the questions to be answered and the problems to be solved by the newly elected personnel who must be sworn into office on or before the effective date of the Charter. One of the first things on the agenda for the councilmen will be the naming of a clerk and treasurer, appointed positions under the terms of the Charter.
Well, despite the overshadowing importance of the national election picture, even though it wasn't a presidential election year, there were some hot local area contests in the August primary and the November finale. One of the most important races was that for representative in the 9th Congressional District. Edward Meany Jr. of Grand Haven and Wesley Thiebaud of Muskegon did their best to beat out the front-running contender Guy Vanderjack of Cadillac. But Vanderjack did better than even the expert had predicted. Meany came in second in the Republican runoff, and Thiebaud ran a poor third. Now, in the November final, Vanderjack easily ran off with a prize over his Democratic opponent, Henry Dong Villo of Fountain. Vanderjack thus fills the seat vacated by our new U.S. Senator, Robert Griffin. Another interesting Republican race in the primary was that of state senator. Grand Haven Councilman David Pooshaw did his best to unseat incumbent Harold Volkema of Holland, but he couldn't swing enough weight in the southern counties. Volkema was easily swept back into office in the final. And then there was the race for circuit judge to serve Ottawa and Allegan counties. At first, everyone gave the post to top runner Wendell Miles, a former county prosecutor and a U.S. district attorney. But as the November election date drew nearer, Miles' opponent, Chester Ray of Allegan, seemed to pick up steam. Ray, also a former prosecutor in Allegan County, drew quite heavy support. And when the counting was completed, Ray emerged the winner by a couple of hundred votes. It was one of the most exciting area elections in years. Elections also made the news in the school column in 1966. Resident of the Spring Lake School District approved a $1.1 million expansion program. Here's the story as it was heard on WGHN on that March morning after the election.
A $1,100,000 building program for the Spring Lake School District has been approved by the voters of the district. A special election was held yesterday, and the results held a margin of about 2-1. On a proposal for a $500,000 bond issue to finance the erecting, furnishing, and equipping additions to the junior-senior high school building and to remodel, improve, and furnish existing school buildings in the Spring Lake District, the vote was 817 yes, 394 no. On a proposal to create a sinking fund for a period of 6 years, the vote was 787 to 408. On a proposal to provide $100,000 a year for needed construction during the next 6 years on a pay-as-you-go basis, continuing the building millage at 10 mills, the vote was 733 yes, 412 no. and on a fourth proposal, this calling for 2 mills for 3 years for operating expenses starting in 1967, the vote was 787 yes, 402 no. After the polls had closed and the ballots had been counted, a happy Spring Lake Superintendent of Schools, Richard Fonger, said this.
On behalf of the school children of Spring Lake and all those involved in the election of our children, we wish to thank the people of the Spring Lake School District for the resounding community spirit shown in yesterday's election. It is gratifying to be able to work together in a united community effort to make our area a better place to live. It's very gratifying to have the people behind the Board of Education and the administration, as they displayed here, in nearly a 2-to-1 vote. And I'm sure that this will enable us to continue a very high-grade, first-class education for our children.
Did you expect a margin that big, Dick?
I really didn't know what to expect, frankly, but we're elated that it was nearly 2-to-1 on all issues.
What about future plans now? How soon will these programs be implemented?
Well, working drawings by the architects will undoubtedly start immediately, and we're hoping that ground can be broken this spring sometime. Of course, we have to sell our bonds first, so it might delay the breaking of ground until this summer, but then we're hoping that our building will be completed by September of 1967.
Doug Chapkus, WGHN News.
By year's end, a $110,000 contract had been awarded as a start on Spring Lake School's expansion. Voters in the Fruitport School District approved a $3.3 million expansion program in October of 1966. Not so successful, however, was the Coopersville School District proposal in December. Voters, by a 2-to-1 margin, rejected a suggested expansion plan, authorizing the school board to borrow $1.1 million to construct and furnish a new middle school. The proposal may be offered to Coopersville District voters again. Just before the end of the year, residents of the Nunica School District, by a narrow margin, rejected proposed annexation to the Spring Lake Schools. You'll be hearing more of Nunica's future in the new year. Many other items made big school news throughout the year. Right after the first of the year, plans were made for dedication and open house of Grand Haven's new Space Age Junior High School that even included a planetarium. WGHN was there for that historic event in March.
Hundreds of residents from West Michigan attended the dedication and open house at Grand Haven's new $2 million junior high building on South Griffin Street last night. Hundreds more are expected to tour the school, claimed by a state school official to be the best junior high building in Michigan, today. The school will be open for tours from 9 a.m. today until 4 p.m. Board of Education member Claude Knoll was in charge of the program in the auditorium last night, which was filled with spectators. A large overflow crowd saw and heard the program via closed-circuit TV in the spacious gymnasium. The school concert band, under Alex Merwin, played several numbers to open the program, and Brigadier William Davis offered prayer. Ray Wiersma and Marvin Patterson of the school board's Citizens Committee gave short talks. J. Van Sweden of Oostrink Construction Company of Grand Rapids then presented a gold key to architect John Vanderbiden, who in turn presented it to Ivan Fosheim of the school board, acting for President Jacob Ponstein, who was ill.
It is always a sense of great pleasure and pride to be selected as a general contractor of any large and beautiful building. And it indeed was a great source of pride to my company to have been selected as a general contractor for this beautiful junior high school. I am sure that you will find this to be a good, serviceable building, one in which you will take a great deal of pride through the years, and I trust will be a great source of education and learning for the children of this district. I wish to present to the architect this gold key, which represents the opening of the doors of this educational institution, and I trust will remain open and be a part of this community for many years. John?
Thank you, Mr. Van Sweden. It is with tremendous pride that I now present to the Vice President of the Board of Education, Mr. Ivan Fossheim, this gold master key.
Thank you very much, John. It gives me a great deal of pleasure on behalf of you, the people of the Grand Haven Area School District, to accept this key, which is symbolic of our taking over the new junior high school.
Other speakers were Superintendent R.M. Van Valkenburg.
Well, this tonight is a very exciting night for all of us because it represents a dream that has become a reality through the efforts of a great many people that have had the vision and the faith in boys and girls to make this possible.
Charles Robertson of the Teachers Committee.
Yes, this really presents a challenge to us. And we say to you, as we dedicate the new Grand Haven Junior High, we accept the challenge.
And Junior High Principal Ted Houston.
Tonight is really a proud moment. And it should be a proud moment for you and for all of our students who have the opportunity of being housed in this magnificent school.
The school choir under Director Al Burgess closed the program with a number of patriotic songs accompanied by Miss Elaine Bolthouse, and the audience sang the national anthem. The theme of the dedication program was An Educational Adventure for a Changing World. Doug Chapkus, WGHN News.
Open house events were also held in 1966 at the Robinson and Rosie Mound Elementary Schools, both in the Grand Haven school system. Both had had additions and remodeling under the school's expansion plan. Still to come is remodeling and an addition to the Grand Haven Senior High School. Assistant Superintendent of Grand Haven Public Schools, Steve Meade, retired in 1966 after 42 years of service to the local school system. A dinner was given in Meade's honor on June 1st. Grand Haven Senior High School Principal Walter Bright was then promoted to Assistant Superintendent of Schools, and William Beach was hired to come to Grand Haven as the new high school principal. A veteran educator took a job outside of the community in 1966. Grand Haven Christian School Principal Wallace Staub resigned to take a position as special education instructor for the Kent Intermediate Area District. Staub had been principal of the local Christian school since 1957. In May, the Christian School Board happily announced that Winfred Karsten of Holland had agreed to come to Grand Haven and be the new principal. In other miscellaneous school news, while other school districts were having their problems with organized teachers in 1966, the Grand Haven and Spring Lake school boards experienced little difficulty in reaching agreement on satisfactory wage scales. After a brief controversy, the Grand Haven Board of Education made it final. The old Grand Haven Junior High building was to be torn down to make room for playground, recreational, and parking areas around the new Central School. Grand Valley State College of Allendale began its fourth year of operation in the fall of 66, in the midst of its greatest expansion of facilities. Two new buildings were nearly completed, another had been finished, and construction on four more had begun. Meanwhile, contracts for two more are in the planning stages to be awarded in the near future. Also at Grand Valley, it was decided in 66 to start granting B.S. degrees in appropriate subject areas in addition to the B.A. degrees already being given. In a major decision of interest in all of Ottawa County and in two school districts of Allegan County, the Ottawa Area Vocational Technical Educational Study Committee came up with a big recommendation to create a community college district of this area. The Ottawa Area Intermediate Board agreed to petition the Higher Education Bureau for approval to create such a district. And finally, school news of a sort. The Grand Haven High School class of 1916 held its big golden anniversary celebration in the community in June of 1966. There were many names in the news. In the city of Grand Haven, veteran city clerk J. Nyhoff Poole retired from office, and a dinner was held in his honor on April 11th. Here's how the story was reported on WGHN the next morning.
Some 150 persons turned out last night to honor retired Grand Haven City Clerk J. Nyhoff Poole. The smorgasbord dinner was arranged by City Assessor George Wessel on behalf of the City of Grand Haven. Mayor William Creason acted as master of ceremonies. Poole's brother Jay reminisced for the audience and told of some of the experiences that he and the recently retired clerk had had when young boys. A framed copy of a WGHN editorial that had been aired upon the announcement of Poole's retirement was read and presented to him. Remarks were made by former Mayor Glenn Eaton and Holland City Auditor John Fonger. Grand Haven City Manager R.V. Terrell read a resolution adopted by the Grand Haven City Council honoring Poole with a Meritorious Service Award.
Whereas May 1st, 1966 marks the date of retirement of Mr. J. Nyhoff Poole, City Clerk, after 37 years of service with the City of Grand Haven, and whereas Mr. Poole's entire tenure during this time has been marked with devoted service, and whereas his contributions to effective standards in municipal accounting have been recognized not only by local officials, but also by state and national members of the Municipal Finance Officers Association. And whereas such recognition has been evidenced by the award to this city of the coveted Certificate of Conformance in Municipal Accounting, and farther by Mr. Poole's election as president of the Michigan chapter of the aforementioned association. Now, therefore, be it resolved that this body hereby indicate its commendation and approval of Mr. Poole's tenure of office, and direct that a proper certificate of meritorious service be prepared and presented to him. Councilman Walhout moved the adoption of the resolution, which motion carried unanimously.
City Councilman David Pushaw presented Poole with a large humorous cartoon depicting the retired clerk as a deer hunter and wishing him happy hunting in the future. Mayor Pro Tem Virgil Kwebeman presented Poole with a portable television set as a gift from the City of Grand Haven and a wind recording instrument on behalf of the Board of Light and Power. When Poole finally stood to make closing remarks, he received a standing ovation. And it was quite obvious that after spending 37 years in service of the city, Poole still couldn't forget shop talk. His closing remarks were not remarks of farewell. They consisted of the quoting of statistics comparing Grand Haven population, taxes, and assessment from when he began work with the city on up to the present date. At the conclusion of the program, the entire audience stood and sung through a chorus of "For He's a Jolly Good Fellow." Doug Chapkus, WGHN News.
Of Spring Lake, village manager William Blaskis announced his resignation to assume a similar position near Detroit. The council named 31-year-old William Robinson, a native of the community, to the post effective October 3rd. These names made news in the Grand Haven JC's file in 1966. In January, James Gerd of Grand Haven Township was cited by the local service club as the community's outstanding young man of the year. In March, Mrs. Paula Montgomery of Grand Haven was named the outstanding JCET of the year for the district. And past president of the Grand Haven Club, Bill Boonstra, was named one of five outstanding JC presidents in the state of Michigan at the JC State Convention in May. Well-known people made the news for the last time in 1966, but their deaths will be mourned for many, many more years to come. In June, Mrs. Marjorie Burwitz of Holland 52-year-old director of social welfare for Ottawa County for 8 years, passed away. The month of August marked the deaths of two well-known men, J. Wesley Lee, 73, of Grand Haven, an industrialist who gave much to his community, died at London, Ontario, and 80-year-old Louis Voink of Borculo, who had served as the Blendon Township Supervisor. In October, WGHN officers mourned the loss of the Vice President of Community Broadcasters Incorporated, William Machma of Holland. Corporation President Doug Chapkis issued this statement at the time.
George Kleiss and I were deeply saddened by the unexpected death of Bill Machma. Even though Bill was a silent partner in our organization, he played a vital role in its founding. When the chips were down and when it seemed as though we would be unable to obtain the necessary financing to purchase station WGHN, Machma came through. Even though he knew very little of us, he demonstrated his faith in us by giving us 100% support at all times. We extend to the Machma family our heartfelt sympathy. To say that his death marks a severe loss to community broadcasters is an understatement, for without him there may not have been such an organization.
Former Grand Haven Mayor Richard L. Cook died in October at the age of 82. In December, former Grand Haven Superintendent of Schools Earl Babcock died at the age of 79. And former Spring Lake Chief of Police Richard Livingstone died at the age of 68 at his new home in Arizona. Speaking of police news, several policemen made the headlines in 1966. Right after the first of the year was learned that Grand Haven Police Chief Richard Kemple was one of the front-running contenders for the job of Holland Police Chief. In fact, the race was narrowed down to two men. Residents of Grand Haven were happy to hear this announcement in February by Holland City Manager Herb Holt.
Les Van Beveren has been selected to be Holland's next police chief effective April 4, 1966, which is the anniversary date of our retiring chief, Jack Van Hoff, and marks 40 years to the day that he has been on duty. It was a difficult decision to make between two well-qualified candidates. One, a mid-career professional of proven ability. The other, this, of course, would be Chief Klempel. The other, Les Van Beveren, is at the beginning of his police career, but he has more formal education and a greater potential. Both men were rated exceptionally high by the panel of top police administrators who did the screening. Holland was most fortunate in having two such outstanding men to choose from. In this situation, the fact that Van Beveren is here and is highly regarded by our local police department and the people of Holland certainly gave him some advantage.
In the continuing problem of policemen leaving the field to take better-paying jobs, the best example of 1966 was probably that of veteran city patrolman Joe McAlevey, who resigned after 19 years on the force to become sales manager of a local automobile agency. In March, Hudsonville Police Chief Willard Tanhave resigned to take a job for the Secretary of State's office. Ronald Bugard of the Walker Township was named his successor. In November, Grand Haven State Police Post Commander Sergeant Arthur Baker was promoted to the rank of Staff Sergeant. And in December, Corporal Edward Hayes of the Grand Haven Post retired. Hayes had joined the state police in 1940 and had been transferred to Grand Haven in 1957. He'll begin the first of the year as Chief Assistant to the Sergeant at Arms of the Michigan State Senate in Lansing. The biggest crime story of the year broke near the end of June, and a WGHN reporter followed the case right from the beginning. State police are still working on the investigation of the death of little 3-year-old Helen Marie Hunzinger, whose body was found strangled in a large trunk at her home near Nunica. Authorities have charged her mother, 25-year-old Mrs. Doris Hunzinger with murder. She denies having any knowledge of the incident. In fact, Mrs. Hunzinger and her boyfriend, Richard Traxler, with whom she lived at Nunica, reported the incident to state police. Mrs. Hunzinger claimed that her former husband killed the child, but authorities seemed quite satisfied with Harry Hunzinger's alibi that he was in California at the time. At year's end, the case still hadn't come to trial. In fact, Mrs. Hunzinger even got a release from the county jail. She was pregnant. Her two-day-old baby boy died in December. The sensational trial will be held in Grand Haven in 1967. Other sensational crime stories of the year included the arrest of three men at Jennison and Grand Rapids in connection with an illegal cigarette operation involving the transportation of untaxed cigarettes from another state to this area. More than 5,500 cartons of the illegal cigarettes were confiscated. The case continues. Also sure to continue making news in 1967 will be the grand jury investigation of an illegal meat operation. In the illegal meat operation, a number of men in Ottawa and Kent counties were indicted by a grand jury after the Attorney General's office revealed that meat from diseased and injured cattle was being used in some cold lunch meats. Regarding the crime rate in 1966, well, the Grand Haven Police Department broke all records in the number of criminal arrests, and the Ottawa County Sheriff's Department, based at Grand Haven, answered more complaints this year than in any other previous year. Building and construction, already mentioned in earlier stories, certainly made some of the big news of the year in this area. Construction began in February on Grand Haven's new $362,000 post office at the corner of 4th and Washington Streets. The building is nearly ready for occupancy and will be dedicated in the first half of 1967. Contracts were awarded in 1966 for Grand Haven's new public library and community center, costing more than $1 million. These buildings, too, will be dedicated in 1967. Construction also began in 66 on a new parish house for St. John's Episcopal Church of Grand Haven, part of a $309,000 building program. And while we're on the topic of church news, St. John's Church observed its centennial in June of 1966. And on the topic of church construction, Grand Haven's beautiful new Second Christian Reformed Church was completed in 1966. The $325,000 structure of colonial design and located at Sheldon and Robbins Road was dedicated in April. Expansion and construction were certainly major topics of discussion in 1966 for those associated with Grand Haven Municipal Hospital. The wheels started moving after a hired consultant presented his initial report. Here's how we reported that story right after the first of the year.
A hospital consulting firm has recommended sweeping improvements for the Grand Haven Municipal Hospital. Last August, the firm of Herman Smith of Chicago was retained to present a master plan covering hospital needs over the next 10 years. The study is being financed by the hospital board, the city of Grand Haven, and the hospital medical staff. Leon Pullen, a partner in the consulting firm, was on hand to meet with representatives of all of the sponsoring organizations last night. He said improvements are needed because Grand Haven is on the grow and present facilities are already woefully inadequate. Pullen stated very simply the basic problems with the local hospital as uncovered by his firm's survey.
One is that you have a growing community. But secondly, and more importantly, the facilities of the present hospital are, in our opinion, generally inadequate. They do not measure up to the 1960 standards. For example, the patient rooms do not have individual toilets. The nursing stations are too small to operate efficiently. There are no examination rooms on the nursing floors. The hospital doesn't have piped oxygen or piped vacuum, audio-visual nurse call systems. The x-ray, laboratory, emergency room, and operating rooms are all too small and they're all poorly located.
After stating the problems, he gave his firm's tentative recommendations.
We're recommending that the hospital expand from its present 54 beds, acute beds, to 100 acute beds, and that the hospital also offer a new service that we call extended care. This relates to the patients who no longer need acute care but still need to be in the hospital. It's a lesser mm-hmm. cost group, and then also the nursing home patient can fit into this group mm-hmm. As well. That's the first major recommendation. That's in terms of numbers of beds. Secondly, we're recommending that a new acute general hospital be built, tied right to the existing facilities, and that they operate as one. When these facilities are completed, there would be two floors of patients in the new building at roughly 50 beds per floor, a new obstetrical department, and, as I mentioned previously, complete new x-ray, laboratory, emergency room, central supply, pharmacy, main entrance to the hospital, and so forth.
And Pullen stated that the recommended improvements will cost money.
The total program, as I've described it, runs about $2.5 million. If it is done in two steps, the first step would be $1,660,000, and the second step, roughly $875,000.
Mm-hmm. Pullen said he felt improvements to the local hospital are very important.
The public expect good facilities and good care. If this hospital doesn't furnish it, then the only direction it can go is downhill. In its facility, the public will stop coming to it, and worse than that, you'll lose your good doctors. And this
yes.
community is very fortunate.
So, where do we go from here?
The next step is this. The board is now studying our tentative report. We're also restudying it ourselves. They'll give us some comments. We will then revise the report, make minor revisions, and finalize it, and submit it to the board. And incidentally, I expect we should be able to do that in 30 to 40 days.
Today, we'll learn the reactions of local city and hospital officials to the tentative proposed changes. Doug Chapkus, WGHN News.
The month of August 1966 saw the dedication of a new bridge near Grand Haven.
The new 420-foot bridge over Stearns Bayou in Robinson Township is now open to traffic. The bridge, replacing a 61-year-old one-lane structure, was formally dedicated in ceremonies yesterday afternoon. It was an historical event because this marks the first hot-dip galvanized bridge in the nation. Some 350 persons were on hand for the ceremonies. The main speaker was Ottawa County Board of Supervisors Chairman Herman Windemuller of Park Township. He ended his address this way.
Many will cross this bridge on foot or by car. Loads of merchandise will move back and forth over its deck. Numerous watercraft will ply the waters which flow beneath it. Many a fisherman will hopefully dabble his line from its rail. Visitors will come from afar to examine this first-of-its-kind structure. Citizens of Ottawa County will view it and use it with pride. To all of these, we dedicate the Stearns Bayou Bridge today.
Gene Dexter, representing the contracting firm of Raff and Dexter of Lansing, which built the bridge, presented the new span to Ottawa County officials.
I am proud to have had a part in this new trek, and I proudly present this bridge to the commissioners of Ottawa County and to the people it will serve in the future.
The bridge was accepted by ceremony's chairman, Neil Van Leeuwen, who is vice chairman of the Ottawa County Board of Road Commissioners.
Well, thank you very much, Gene. The Road Commission is very proud to accept this bridge from the contractor.
2 hours after the ceremonies began, the bridge was opened to traffic for the first time. Doug Chapkus, WGHN News.
There were two strikes of significance in the community in 1966. Our third largest industry, Oberg Manufacturing Company, was crippled by a strike starting July 18th and ending October 1st. The community's second largest industry, Bastion Blessing Company, was hit by a brief strike in December. The strike began on the 17th, ended on the 20th. Our neighboring community to the south, Holland, was struck by two major walkouts at the Chriscraft Corporation and the Romer Steel Yacht Division of Chriscraft. WGHN received a pleasant surprise in September. It won first prize in state competition for its... Well, here's the story as it was aired on WGHN the next morning.
It's always my pleasure to come up here and recognize the people who put aviation in front of the general public. They do an excellent job. And these awards, annually given by the Michigan Association of Airport Managers, are growing in prominence each year because of the recognition extended to folks such as we have here tonight. And now for the best promotion of aviation by a Michigan radio station, I'd like to call up Jenny Groh. Jenny? In winning this award, I think the others are self-explanatory, what we've done thus far. But for radio, why, Jenny ran a series on learning to fly. She worked with Mary Cresson, who is the wife of the mayor of your town down there and so forth. And she soloed and has a few solo hours. And she, by taping her experiences, gave the people of her community an idea of what happened. These stories appeared on WGHN in Grand Haven. So it's my pleasure, this seventh annual award, for the best promotion of aviation by a Michigan radio station, Jenny Groh, WGHN Grand Haven. Congratulations, Jenny.
Well, this is indeed an honor, and I'd like to express my appreciation to all of you, but really, I didn't do it alone. I had my instructor, Mary Cresson, and my production director and our chief announcer, Dan Bethel. He's now turned photographer. But it's really been teamwork, and we're real happy to have this trophy at WGHN in Grand Haven. And they say that I must, at station break time, include 1370 on your dial. Thank you.
The Grand Haven JCs made work of one of their dream projects in 1966, the establishing of a new roadside park for the community along U.S. 31 at the North City limits. Big strides were made, and following a contest, it was decided that the park would be named the Ricks Robinson Park, after one of the early explorers in our area. Many residents of the area were surprised last fall to hear the contents of an expose by the WGHN News Department.
2 years in a row, Edwin Henry Lemick of Windsor, Ontario, came here to the U.S. Coast Guard Anniversary Festival. And 2 years in a row, he was treated with esteem. In 1965, Lemick was treated as a dignitary at the Coast Guard Festival. He was here to display a beautiful stamp collection regarding ships on the Great Lakes, identifying himself as a retired commander in the Canadian Coast Guard. He was housed by a local stamp enthusiast. He attended the various official functions of the festival, and he rode in the big Saturday afternoon parade. In 1966, Lemick notified local officials that he would be here again, arriving on the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Castle Rock,
one of two ships that came to Grand Haven for this year's festival as a part of the Coast Guard Cadet summer cruise. This time, Lemick said he was doing research for the Royal Canadian Naval Department of Affairs. He said he was writing the material for one or more major publications. He didn't arrive aboard the Castle Rock. He missed boarding the ship due to a doctor's appointment. But it was learned that he had obtained official clearance from the U.S. Coast Guard to travel here on the cutter. Even though he was not treated with as much fanfare during the 1966 festival, he impressed many local residents and even the press. The Saturday, August 6th edition of the Grand Haven Tribune carried a feature story about Commander Lemick. He told the writer that he had received good news on Friday, August 5th. He had been promoted to captain in the Canadian Coast Guard Department of Transport and would command the icebreaker Oceanographer, the largest Canadian icebreaker and the third largest in the world. The ship was to have been commissioned on August 26th in Montreal. Commander Lemick claimed to have been the winner of the Victoria Cross of the Royal Canadian Navy and said he was also awarded the next cross in the Order of the Cross of St. John as Companion of the Bath of the Order of Star and Garter. He told the press that his new title was Captain Sir Edward Henry Lemick. Lemick told how, as a young man, he had enlisted as a seaman in the Royal Canadian Navy and rose through the ranks to commander. He said his duty on minesweepers in the English Channel won him the Victoria Cross, and that a movie starring William Holden and Sophia Loren entitled They Don't Have to Come Back was based in part on his military career. Lemick said that he was well known in Canada and the Great Lakes areas as the Canadian Coast Guardsman. After hearing rumors about town in recent weeks, WGHN began a check with Canadian officials, as well as officials of the Tri-Cities Chamber of Commerce. Thanks to A.H.G. Stores, Director of Marine Operations for the Canadian Department of Transport, Colonel L.A. Bourgeois, Director of Information Services for the Canadian Department of National Defense, Claude Verdine, Executive Vice President of the Tri-Cities Chamber of Commerce, and other sources, WGHN learned the following. 1. Mr. Lemick had indeed obtained permission to come to Grand Haven aboard the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Castle Rock for the 1966 festival. Red-faced Coast Guard officials admitted that they hadn't checked out his references and credentials. 2. Mr. Lemick is not now and has never served in the Royal Canadian Navy or the Canadian Coast Guard. 3. The Canadian Department of Transport does not have an icebreaker called the Oceanographer. Instead, she is one of America's newest and most automated research ships, a part of the Environmental Science Services Administration research fleet. 4. The Victoria Cross was won by only one member of the Royal Canadian Navy during the period 1939 to 1945, and this was a posthumous award to a man who had been killed in action. 5. The St. John Ambulance has no record of anybody named Lemick having been a member of the order. 6. There is no such organization as the Royal Canadian Navy Department of Affairs. And 7. There is no such thing as an Order of the Star and Garter. That is the name of a pub in London, England. Doug Chapkus, WGHN News.
Grand Haven's popular and well-known VFW Color Guard was honored in a special celebration.
20 years of continuous service by the official Color Guard of the Yunker Post, Veterans of Foreign Wars in Grand Haven, was honored at a community dinner last night at the VFW building. Major General Cecil Simmons of Grand Rapids was the featured speaker. Mayor Pro Tem Virgil Quebeman of Grand Haven and other civic leaders praised the Honor Guard for its service to the community in parades, military burials, and other events. Herman Van Zantwick, historian for the group, reported that the Guard has been called on at least 1,000 times since it was formed in 1946. The group was first led by Thomas Gozen and was organized from a group of recently returned World War II veterans. Major General Simmons, commanding general of the 46th Infantry of the Michigan National Guard, reviewed the development of the National Guard since World War II and told of the part it has played in the Korean conflict, the Cuban crisis, recent street riots in large cities, and other crises. and he concluded his address this way.
I like the passage from The Arms and the Man so well that I asked that it be put on the new armory in Grand Rapids. And it goes something like this. That a man shall serve his country in time of war is noble, brave, and patriotic. But that a man shall properly prepare himself in times of peace for war is all this and more. It is noble with a nobility which is real, not ideal. It is brave with a bravery which assumes in time of unemotional peace many burdens, among them that of bearing the lack of appreciation for those who do not believe that military training is necessary. And thank you very much.
Commander Jack Veltman of the local post presented the speaker and his wife with gifts, and John Bazzani introduced the present members of the Honor Guard: Frank Wesley, Louis Buren, Norman Parsons, Russell Ringelberg, Howard Retzloff, Howard Farrain, Lee Rumler, John Veltman, Kenneth Sibley, Jack Schmidt, Lloyd Kieft, Bugler Melcher, Willard Case, Assistant Commander, and Shield. Dwayne Baker was toastmaster, and he introduced many guests, including Herm Van Zantwick, who gave a history of the group, Clarence Schumacher of Rockford, state official of the VFW, Wayne Tagg, district commander from Freeport, Henry Parker, president of the Grand Haven CED, Captain William Brems of Company A of Grand Haven, Commander Larry McFadden of the American Legion, and Louis Winraldi, service officer of the VFW Post. Veltman thanked local industrialists through the CED for permitting members of the Color Guard to have time off with pay so they can assist at events during working hours. The program was closed with an impressive ceremony at which the present honor guard, with Carl Scheil, the commander, fired volleys from the nearby parking lot. And in conclusion, Bugler Melcher sounded taps.
A Ferrisburg teenager was selected Miss North Ottawa County and Miss U.S. Coast Guard in 1966.
Very important to understand that if for any reason the new Miss North Ottawa County U.S. Coast Guard should be unable to fulfill her duties, her title would be assumed by the first runner-up. She is the second most important person in our pageant. Now, first runner-up, number 7, Susan Joy Morris. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss North Ottawa County. Number 11, Peggy Louise Firm.
Peggy Louise Firm is the daughter of Ferrisburg Councilman and Mayor Pro Tem Bill Firm. Another pretty woman from the area also received special honors in 1966. Mrs. Gary Freeman of Holland, who along with her husband live at the Christian Reformed Conference grounds in Grand Haven Township during the summer months, was crowned Mrs. Michigan. Mrs. Freeman didn't fare quite as well, however, in the national competition at San Diego, but the county still claimed ownership of the 1966 Mrs. Michigan, probably the first such honor for Ottawa County in history. June 1966 marked a first for the Grand Haven Harbor. The biggest ship on record to ever enter the harbor arrived. Here's how we reported that story.
The local harbor has received a visit from the largest ship ever to come through the channel. The huge 640-foot Roy A. Jodry, owned by the Algoma Central Railway Company of Sault Ste. Marie, turned around late yesterday afternoon in Lake Michigan before making its way into the channel. Residents throughout the area heard the whistle of the ship as she backed into the harbor. A small delegation was on hand to greet the Canadian ship and her captain at the Construction Aggregates Corporation where she docked. The local delegation, which included WGHN reporter Dave Marcus, was given a tour of the ship. And then came the presentations.
First Ferriesburg Mayor Gene Babcock made this presentation to Captain T.R. White.
Captain, we would like to congratulate you, welcome you on behalf of the city of Ferriesburg and the Tri-Cities area.
Thank you.
Compliment you on the successful trip you had into the harbor, and we would like to present you with a memento of our area, which explains our musical fountain, which we hope you might have an opportunity to view at your leisure this evening or any evening that you might be in port. I certainly hope that you have a good trip back.
Thank you very much.
Then came a representative from the Grand Haven official family, City Councilman Paul Leitches.
Captain, on behalf of the City of Grand Haven, its mayor, the City Council, and all the citizens, we welcome you here. Grand Haven has long been known as a lake port, and before the turn of the century, a world port, shipping lumber by the thousands and millions of feet. And at that time, there was quite a history to the shipping of Grand Haven, and we're certainly proud to be with you here now as you write another chapter in the history of our port.
Well, thank you.
And if you ever are back here and like to enjoy our city or our community for a vacation, we'd certainly like to have you come. You're welcome.
Well, thanks very much.
Finally, it was time to get to work. The Roy A. Jodry was loaded with more than 15,000 tons of sand by early this morning and was ready for the trip to Port Waller, Ontario, with her cargo. Until yesterday, the largest ship ever to visit the Grand Haven Harbor was the 612-foot Benson Ford. Doug Chapkus, WGHN News.
Water was a big topic of the year. The city of Wyoming's Big Lake Michigan water pipeline that originates in Park Township was completed and put into use. And then in December, the city of Hudsonville became the first paying customer of Wyoming by tapping into the pipeline. Closer to home, a plan was approved to extend water service from the city of Grand Haven to the industrial area of Grand Haven Township around Hayes Street and U.S. 31. The water is piped to the area down Ferry Street. It was a windy, cold, wintry day on that December 2nd, 1966, when the water service was officially started. Standing in the wind and the snow, here's what Mayor William Creason said.
I'd like to publicly thank John Boss and his committee for the fine work they've done. I think that this is an example where, even though you have problems, problems are not necessarily confined to governmental boundaries, nor are the solutions to these problems. I think that Grand Haven Township and the city of Grand Haven have arrived at a solution to a problem here of supplying water to the industrial area. I think it's a fine one, and I think it's going to economically help this area grow in the future.
And finally, the human interest story of the year that made big headlines, even hit Time magazine, the story of a Cinderella. A housewife from Swartz Creek became richer by $1,600,000 in October. Following a hearing in Ottawa County Probate Court, Judge Frederick Miles determined that 42-year-old Mrs. Rosemary Jelnick was the sole heir of the estate of the late Arthur F. Cruz. Cruz, a Spring Lake bachelor who lived at 15623 View Drive, died last March 18th while returning from a trip to Spain. Nobody apparently realized that Cruz was a millionaire. Also, nobody realized that he had any close relatives. It appeared that his six cousins would inherit the estate. But then it was learned, through much investigation, that Cruz had a sister, now deceased, who had had a daughter. The child had been placed in an orphanage and had been adopted by Mr. and Mrs. William Lindboom of Grand Rapids. They renamed the girl and never told her of her parentage. She grew up in Grand Rapids and married Calvin Jelnick. Until recently, Mrs. Jelnick never knew the real story. In October, she learned that her name was indeed at one time Eugenia Cruz Corbin. And then she learned that she was a millionaire, the sole heir to to the $1.6 million estate of Arthur Cruz. And so there you have a bird's eye glimpse of that wonderful year, 1966. Our hope is that your new year will be even more wonderful, more blessed. From the news department and the entire staff and management of WGHN to you, a happy new year. This has been the year in review. A brief wrap-up of some of the major stories that made headlines in 1966 in and around the Tri-Cities. The Year in Review, written and produced by the WGHN News Department.